I'm Kathy Fuller here with Andrew Rangel. We hear a lot of Andrew on our air. It is so nice to have you here live and in person. Thank you for coming.
I'm delighted to be here.
Born in Chicago, raised in Colorado, went to Juilliard. You won the big Avery Fisher Career Grant way back when, and then there were 7 years of hand injury, which were, I think, ultimately maybe enlightening but frustrating. And then you are now deeply immersed in Bach, making many recordings of Bach, among other things. But I want to know first, I think many people would wonder, who first opened that door for you into the world of Bach?
Well, I mean, two words, Glenn Gould.
Uh-huh.
I mean, there's absolutely no doubt about it. I definitely remember at the age of 10 or 11 hearing Gould's first recordings of the Italian Concerto, the B-flat Partita, the D-minor Concerto, and then shortly thereafter the Goldberg Variations, and it was just electrifying to me. So,
who was dropping that needle for you?
Well, I was blessed to have a father, not a musician. He was a kind of a Renaissance man and a doctor and a wonderful artist and a great reader. But he had a record collection. He and my mother had a very diverse record collection. This was quite long ago. And he had a collection encompassing classical, jazz, Broadway, folk music. And it was listening to his classical records that brought me Gould and others.
Well, there have now been lots of your own Bach recordings, and in a sense, you're doing as Gould did. I think you like the recording session. Is that true? You like to be in a recording, or is that a struggle, or what happens when you go into a recording session?
Of course, a recording session is a struggle in the sense that there's a great deal at stake. You take it very seriously, I do, and prepare as much as possible. But there is also a very open factor of what exactly will happen. And the good news, of course, is that you have the time and you have the opportunity to create an abundance of interesting material. And especially if you are not constrained or by the concept of absolutely having to play, as in a concert performance, from beginning to end. And this is a very liberating thing. Pianists will say there's only one kind of struggle worse than a stage performance, and that's a studio session. I don't feel that way, and this has to do with my all the way back to my injury and the fact that I have shifted for many years, for several decades, to the studio from the stage. I very seldom play, especially on a big stage.
You picked a very liberating place to make this recording. The Performance Center Shaolin Lu in Rockport is certainly an inspiring place to play.
Oh, my God. It's really just amazing. You play a few feet away from a large picture window facing the ocean, and you know, I try to record mostly in daylight, which I just love. And you're sitting on a stage. And it's quiet. It's small. There's very little noise. And then you look around, and it's just stunning.
And there's some seagull who reminds you how to make a phrase.
Exactly. All of that. Exactly.
I saw Dawn Upshaw do a recital there. At one point, she said, "Excuse me, would you mind?" And she just turned around. It was great. Well, this latest recording, which we have chosen at WCRB as our CD of the week, is called A Bouquet of Bach. And I guess the heart of the bouquet are the inventions, 2- and 3-part inventions. Could you, let's say I'm somebody, I have no idea what a Bach invention is. What is it and how does it work?
Well, the Bach inventions and sinfonias, or the 2- and 3-part inventions, were written, first of all, at a time when Bach's first children, of many, were quite young, and they are teaching pieces. None of them is more than a couple of minutes long, and most of them are closer to 1 minute. The inventions make the most of a discussion between just 2 lines, and all of them start with a small, easily identifiable theme, which is pursued almost without deviation in the course of this minute or minute and a half. And somehow Bach manages to create 30 different adventures. The counterpoint and the sense of development of these themes is really quite endless and very sophisticated.
Is it for you two characters who are interacting for the most part, or is it much more abstract than that?
I would say it is more abstract, and I would add, of course, that what characterizes all of Bach, from these very simple pieces to the most advanced fugal efforts in the art of fugue or in the well-tempered clavier, is a habit of writing consistently in a polyphonic or multi-voice texture, which he adheres to and which is his language, and which has its own sense of foreground and background, which to me is the lifeblood of it and the fun of it also.
You know, you mention in your notes this gorgeous one, the F minor three-part invention, which is, and you say something beautiful. You say it's three interlocking themes, so you have those three lines, performing a unique, solemn, and magical ritual. And you know that what that sounds like is some great choreographer coming up with a design for a modern ballet, for instance. That sounds like a choreography to me. And in a certain sense, you have to think of Bach and choreography. But these lines are sort of dancing in and out of each other. Is that right?
Dancing in that one is not so much dancing as moving slowly in completely different ways. This is kind of a unique work. It has been described technically as a kind of a triple fugue because each one of these themes is fully developed, and yet almost always all three of them are present. And there is something very enigmatic and something also very sensual about this combination. And, you know, to your earlier point, I think we should contact Mark Morris. Could make an amazing 3 minutes. Just three dancers.
Absolutely. That's what I mean. I mean, not dancing to a pulse or dancing to some form, but dancing as characters, as states sort of intertwining. And when you play that piece, you seem to be willing to let some of the lines and some of the gestures seem very vulnerable. There's the chance that something might dissolve. I mean, in Bach, there's always the sense that everything's going to be okay. We always get solace, right, from Bach. But there are these deep moments when things aren't necessarily okay. And how is it that I'm getting that out of that little piece in your playing in just a couple of minutes?
Here's my guess. It struck me that you used the word vulnerable, which is – and that there is something very deeply emotional about this particular piece. And yet there is often a quality in Bach where there is a kind of underlying darkness or an outright lament. And this is not the forthright Bach that the cliche of he puts it there, it works, it's mechanically amazing, play it clearly and you'll be okay, as our teacher said. No. There is a quality of something that is not absolutely forthright, that has a kind of shape that is possibly a little bit variable. And that, in other words, there's a tiny factor of uncertainty throughout that I think must be preserved. And this definitely applies to many of the fugues in the Well-Tempered, that instead, again, of presenting them always as something just there and intact, the great composers have a way of moving in and out of intactness, where something is not quite present or not quite over, if that makes any sense.
Absolutely. I'm going to quote you on that.
Well,
and that intactness, we worry for it, but Bach tends to, in the end, very often comfort us about it. Is that true, do you think?
Well, one thing about Bach is that there is always a very satisfying conclusion, not in the sense that it was easily arrived at, because Bach is, apart from being the master of everything else, he is also the master of the end game. How many times do you hear a difficult or interesting fugue, and you feel at a certain juncture, oh, the final statement of this theme, it's happening, or it's in sight, but we're not quite yet there at the end. There is such a thing as a deceptive cadence, or a whole sort of oblique approach to the end, and Bach can do this amazingly well. Not so many times in these pieces, although I would add that some of the longer minor key three-part inventions are very sophisticated in that way and have...
Three's a crowd. Once you've got three, you know, it's right. Different than two, isn't it?
Well, it's definitely a bit more complicated. And some of the endings are very subtle. And actually, one last point is, this goes to your observation about the satisfying or conclusiveness of Bach's endings. I have actually chosen at least half the time to leave it in the minor, if it's in a minor key, even though many of them go to the major.
And he asks for the major.
Well, he asks in the same way he asks for a repeat or an ornament. Uh-huh. I think it's a choice.
Okay. Well, that's you and Bach having a thing.
That's us, right.
I like that too. I think if it's in the minor, sometimes the major sounds a little trite, you know.
You don't want to overdo it.
Yeah. Well, the recording opens with this early set of variations, and you point out you began really, in a sense, your big recording career with the Goldberg variations, which are the sort of the Bible of pianists, the Great Testament, right? Those stand there, but then there's only one other set of variations. Is that true? And that's this little one?
Well, of keyboard variations. There are other variations. And in another sense, you might even say that the art of fugue is, at least conceptually, a huge set of variations on different treatments of the same theme. But in the conventional sense, the Goldberg Variations is the monument at the end of Bach's life, and the so-called Italian Variations, Aria Variata, is a very early and, I think, entertaining piece. There's nothing terribly deep about it, but it's very vivid, very snappy, and very fun. And oddly enough, it is the theme that is the most interesting part. And that, like in the Goldberg, the theme comes back at the end. It's a very rich polyphonic theme, and all of the variations are actually, for the most part, in just two-part.
Let's just say, for people who don't know what a set of variations is, what is it that you can vary? You have this tune, right? What things can you vary as you go from variation to variation? What elements can you muck with and still come up with a set of variations?
Well, these two sets that Bach wrote, and especially the Goldberg Variations, essentially what is being varied is the underlying chord progression and or the underlying bass line, as opposed to a thematic variation. What is astounding in the Goldberg Variations is that you can just be carried everywhere and never hear anything even remotely suggesting the theme. Even though, well, that's another discussion, because in fact there are very subtle subsections or subparts which are present. But basically, the Aria Variata is a harmonic set of variations, and there's very little variations in the piece. There's a lot of changes of texture and of mood, but it all goes by very quickly.
And those changes of mood, those are what we really hear. And you have this way of playing with a sort of insistence on certain rhythmic gestures, which I think is lovely and very bright. And in this set of variations, I think people will be surprised that this is a piece by Bach they just haven't heard before, and it's lovingly played.
Well, one, of course, does try to commit completely to whatever one feels invested in and what one wants to, in a sense, project or give the world. Not all that long ago, I recorded Für Elise, not because it's my absolute go-to favorite Beethoven piece, but because I thought it was, aside from being maybe the world's most popular small piece, a very interesting little rondo which needed a good deal of experience and subtlety to make the most of it. And I kind of feel that way about Bach's aria Variata. And I would add that to me, it is odd that this piece is so much of an entertainment, more like a Galant style piece that was in fashion at the time of Bach's death and that his kids made the most of.
Well, it's called In the Italian Manner,
yes,
right?
Yes.
So they were pretty entertaining.
Yes, I think that's true.
So then you go, you've got these fantastic Egon Petri things. And
oh, yeah.
he was a student of Busoni. He was an amazing pianist himself.
Yeah, and
right?
violinist, believe
and
it.
Violinist. And so he took many of Bach's pieces and did what with them?
In the case of the three that I selected, he did very different things in that, let's see now, one of the pieces is practically Bach's last work, in a sense, a chorale prelude, I Step Before Thy Throne. In this instance, Petri supplies a very straightforward and rather austere transcription. He's making very small embellishments in deepening register, that kind of things. It's very grand. But in another one of these, Petri kind of creates a new piece out of three tiny minuets from the Bach little notebook for Wilhelm Friedemann. And he takes these dinky little minuets, two of them in G major, one of them in G minor, and makes an amazing rondo form in which the main minuet is reharmonized and also retexturized, and it is the most delicious and the most inventive kind of treatment of these three. And for me, it has the effect of completely creating something more than the sum of the three parts and actually making the interaction, to me at least, much more interesting than these little creations, as nice as they are individually.
And so Bach was doing it for his kid to basically learn the fine art of playing the keyboard. But then Petri, when would he have been writing these transcriptions? And we're talking 20th century, early 20th century, right?
Here's a rough guess. I would say he was born in the 1880s and died somewhere around 1960 or in the 60s.
Right. So he's seeing the world from a whole other point of view. So these are charming, unbelievably,
yeah,
just knock you over your head charming.
I think so.
It's just almost a shock to hear them, you know, on this recording. It's just, wow, this is just beautiful.
You know, I was enchanted. I have to tell you, I'm old enough to have heard a recording of Petri, a Westminster recording from the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it may have had the Busoni Fantasia Contrapuntistica,
yes, on
it.
Yes, he's famous for that, yeah.
But it had a number of these transcriptions, including Sheep May Safely Graze, which is the other.
Which is here, too.
Which is another one. And I was just so in love with this minuet transcription that I looked for it. It was very hard to get, but it's been a favorite of mine forever.
It is just gorgeous. Well, let's segue off of the notebook for his child to your Bach for Kids CD. I just want to mention that because you have this very tender ability to make up stories, and you've written a beautiful story about a little boy who loves his pajamas and added many of your recordings. Who doesn't? Exactly. And it is a story for kids, which comes with that other CD that you made on the Steinway label. And you have illustrated it all. I think that is a remarkable thing. And now you're telling me that we happen to be in the Beethoven year. You're going to do another one. You're illustrating another story.
Yeah, it's on the way out. It'll be released, I think, 1st of May. So it's in a final stage of packaging. And like the Bach for Kids, a Beethoven for Kids will consist of two discs in the package. One is a short recital of very arresting and wonderful individual pieces by Bach in one case and Beethoven in the other. So that's a CD selected from many earlier recordings of mine. And conceived as a kind of an interesting, unpredictable sort of amalgam of wonderful things and ostensibly aimed at kids, but not really. It's aimed at you and my colleagues and, you know, Jeremy Eichler and your grandmother and everybody. But also in each set is a DVD with a children's story narrated, illustrated by me, and decorated with wonderful music, Bach in the case of the story of Peter Pajamas, and mostly Beethoven, although there are some other very funny little moments. Like there's a moment in that story where Sammy Snake is climbing through a narrow pipe. Luckily, he himself is narrow. And the music you hear is the opening of the Stravinsky Sonata, which is a very sort of climbing little slithery. So
that's fantastic.
It's fun.
Well, I am grateful to you for being able to do that and for going ahead and do that. It's one thing to think of something like that, but to carry it out. And these paintings and drawings are remarkable. So I highly recommend the four children recordings that you're doing. I want to just touch briefly on this recording, this new CD of the week. Why do you think Bach has become so elemental to so many players? And why do some players just not play him? I mean, everybody right. needs to study Bach, but right. not everybody goes and plays it.
Well, Bach presents a kind of language and a sort of conceptual challenge, which from these very small pieces to, again, to his suites and some of which are very long and difficult, to the monumental pieces at the end of his life, the Goldberg Variations, the Art of Fugue, that places a very high premium on not only clarity, but of an understanding of what is possible to say without wasting a note in either 1 minute or 3 minutes or 7 minutes or, you know, some of these pieces are an hour long. I, as I mentioned before, I was pulled into it by the sheer visceral persuasion of hearing great Bach. And I think that at least in my lifetime, I have the feeling that more and more pianists are playing Bach, are playing it on piano. I mean, you know, years and years ago, even that was questioned, which seemed insane to me, if I may say so, just because so many marvelous things that are inherent in Bach can be beautifully realized, given what the piano provides for you. On the other hand, the attraction of playing a lot of notes and swirls of notes and figurational kind of writing in which the Romantics all specialized is overwhelming and can be the main draw. And, you know, the piano is a kind of virtuoso instrument. And I think that is why people who make careers have to, as they always have for the past more than 100 years, play the big audience pleasing pieces, certainly all the concerti, although I might say Bach also wrote some very wonderful concerti. But I think that there's an intellectual appeal and challenge to Bach, and all of us who study anywhere at any reputable institution know that Bach is encouraged and demanded, and in fact compulsory, because it's on every jury. And all important, even competitions, I probably require some major Bach piece. So, but it's in the category of a special area or, you know, a good pill or something like that. So that you can enjoy all the whipped cream and list.
I guess everybody sort of plays it for themselves, but only some people sort of can really spend their lives with it.
The flip side of the discipline is that there is a joy not present in swirls of notes, where every single note counts. And if you can command this conversation and characterize a theme and a counter subject and an episode in relation to a theme, or specially invest a saraband or any one of the stylized dances in a suite with what Bach was struggling over and over to do, there is something very, very satisfying in this kind of endeavor. And it's you know, been nourishing for me my whole life.
Thank you so much, Andrew Rangel. We'll be listening to this a lot, and we'll have this on our air a lot, and we're appreciative of it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kathy.